The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in the ancient Buddhist literature, there's this story. There's lots and lots and lots of stories. But there's this one story where Sakya, who is the king of the gods, and in the Buddhist cosmology, when we hear this word gods, we should think more like Greek gods, more like Zeus and Athena or something, than a creator god or an omniscient god or something like that. They're more like, they have human characteristics, and they are not enlightened. Okay, so Sakya, who is king of the gods, he asks the Buddha this question. When all beings, right? So he knows all beings, right? The king of gods. He knows what all the other gods are doing and what all the humans are doing. When all beings wish to live in peace, why are they perpetually embroiled in conflict? We might ask this question ourselves. When we ourselves don't wish to be disturbed, upset, in the midst of conflict, in the midst of disputes, I don't think anybody does. I don't think, well, maybe there are some people who really like that, but I think that for most of us, we wish to have some ease, some peace, some openness, some freedom. But why is it that we so often find ourselves in conflict, or there happens to be conflict so much around? And it's not just the king of gods who asks this question. So the Buddha, here's some verses where a little bit of an autobiography, he's speaking about before he was enlightened, before he was an awakened, when he was just a practitioner. He says this: just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken, seeing people thrash about like fish in little water, and seeing them feuding with each other. I became afraid. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. Then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions, but when the arrow's pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. For me, this is quite touching, where the Buddha describes that he became afraid when he saw that it's just conflict everywhere, disputes everywhere. This might have been part of what prompted him to want to seek enlightenment. There's this idea that there's got to be an end of suffering, the suffering that we cause each other and the suffering that we experience in ourselves. And so he was shaken and afraid at the violence and the conflict. A few verses earlier in this discourse, he talked a little bit about how he was concerned about the violence. So it wasn't just the conflict. But he saw an arrow embedded in people's hearts, his heart and other people's hearts. And importantly, he saw that this arrow could be removed, that there could be the turmoil, the problems could be quelled. And we could say that a big part of the Buddhist teachings are how to remove this arrow from our hearts. So then, of course, the question is, well, what is this arrow? And there's quite a few discourses that where the Buddha talks about what are the causes of conflict. What are the causes of disputes? What's underlying them? Why do we do this? Importantly, of course, like, how can we find a different way? So and the Buddha points to a number of different things, and some of them being more obvious and some of them being more subtle, and like in everything in between. And often with there being a connection. Here's an obvious reason, and then if you look closely, here's a subtle reason that's underneath it. And then to point to one of these, I'd like to say one more story that comes out of the Buddhist literature. You might know this story. I wouldn't be surprised. It's not uncommon. In fact, for me, I like this, that This same story is shared with quite a few religious traditions. It's in their sacred literature of ancient India. The Jains have this, what later became Hinduism has this, the Buddhists have this. And even, I think it was in the mid-1800s, somebody wrote a poem about this. So the scholars like to, you know, worry about and fight about about where that started and who copied who. But one way we could think about this is maybe it's just some wisdom. Maybe it was just some wisdom that people had. And this story was just a story that was passed down through the generations, and the different religions recognized, oh yeah, there's some wisdom here, and then they just all co-opted it for themselves. We'll never know, but here's the story. So there was a king, and he asked a servant to go round up quite a few people who were blind and had been blind from birth. And then the servant does this, brings them to the king, and the king says, okay, show them to an elephant, but show them in a particular way. So this servant, for one blind person, shows him the elephant's head, and only the head. Another blind person, he shows the elephant's ear. A third blind person, he shows the elephant's tusk. This goes on to the trunk, the body, the foot, the hindquarters of the elephant, the tail, and even the tuft at the end of the tail. So each blind person gets shown a different part of this elephant and is told, here, this is an elephant. You know, okay, maybe it's an elephant, part of an elephant. And then the king asks these blind people, what is an elephant like? And one person who had been shown the elephant said, it's like a water jar. And the person that had been shown the elephant's ear said, no, it's like a winnowing basket. And the person that had been shown the elephant's tusk said, no, an elephant is sharp and pointy like an arrow. The person that had been shown the elephant's trunk thought it was like a pole that's part of the plow. Another person thought the foot was like the mortar, and the tail was like the pestle, so you know, like mortar and pestle where you ground things. And then the tuft at the end of the tail, the person who was shown that said that it was a broom. Of course, they all have different ideas what an elephant is, because they had different experiences. They had felt different parts and had come to different conclusions. But then the blind people said, no, an elephant is not like that. It's like this. It's not. It's like this. It's not like that. And then they fell to blows, punching each other, hitting each other. And then in this story, the king takes great delight in this spectacle of these people fighting and having this disagreement and coming to blows. So they became quarrelsome and wounding each other with verbal daggers. I like this expression, wounding with verbal daggers. Sometimes we do this, right? We say things that are hurtful. And also harming each other with their physical blows. And then the Buddha, at the end of this teaching, he gives a verse that goes like this. Some religious practitioners, so-called, are deeply attached to their own beliefs. People who only see one side of things engage in quarrels and disputes. Right? It's easy to imagine everybody thought that they were correct, and they were correct according to what their experience had been, but they didn't stop to think, why is this other person saying something that is so different than what I'm saying? Why does this person think that it's more like a basket when I'm pretty sure it's more like a jar? Why is somebody saying it's like a pestle when I'm pretty sure it's like an arrow? So these individuals, these blind people, they aren't lying. They aren't trying to be mean. they just have these ideas based on their experience, and they had different experiences. So in the same way, we all have a tendency to claim that we know, based on our experience, but not taking into mind, not taking into account that our experience may be limited. Yes, we may have a picture, we may know this, but we may not know something else that would change the way that we view something that we've experienced. So, as this story points to, clinging, being really attached to, holding on very tightly to our beliefs, to our opinions, underlies conflict, a lot of conflict. For those of you, many of you may know that in the Buddhist tradition, there is the teaching and an emphasis of the importance of not clinging to anything, because it leads to suffering. And this is just one particular example how clinging to our beliefs leads to conflict, and conflict is suffering. Not getting along with others is suffering. So not clinging to our beliefs, our opinions, our philosophies, our doctrines, our religious teachings, including ideas about religious truths, even Buddhist teachings. It's not that we don't have them. It's not that we don't have experiences. It's not that we don't have ideas. It's not that we don't have views and beliefs. That isn't what the problem is. We need those. Of course we need those to help guide and navigate our behavior and the way that we are in the world and the way that we make sense of our experience. It's the clinging. It's the attachment. It's the holding on to. It's the being sure that I know what is right and everybody else is somehow mistaken. You might be a really nice person, but you're wrong. Right? It's those types of ideas that get us into trouble. Somehow when we hold on tightly to our views, we hold on tightly to our beliefs, this can generate some dogmatism, some fundamentalism. I think all of us know that, right, that of course doesn't lead to a place where allows people to flourish and have the a lot of freedom and ease and peace. Holding on to our beliefs leads to conceit. In the Buddhist view, conceit has a number of different meanings, but in this way, we can say it has the conventional English meaning, this idea of I know better and you don't. Along with that is a sense of self-righteousness. And of course, some indignation too. Like, how dare they? I can't believe they think this. And it's for these reasons, of course, why we often say, well, don't talk about politics or religion at the, you know, the Thanksgiving dinner or something like this, right? Because often people, when they want to have a belief or they have a belief and they start to share it, then others start to, without even really noticing or understanding why, start to feel this contraction. They feel threatened. They feel uncomfortable. And then we get locked into these two corners. This person believes this. This other person believes that. And not only that, there was a time when I lived in a place where my neighbors, for some reason, almost like clockwork, around 9 p.m., would start yelling at each other. I couldn't understand what they were saying, but oh my gosh, it made me so anxious. I was surprised how anxious it made me just to hear this yelling. I couldn't understand. I think it was a parent to a child. So it just, you know, this weeks, months, years of it's kind of like yelling at 9 p.m. There's something would happen. So it's not only when we get into conflict or when we ourselves are in disputes, but when other people are in conflict and disputes, when we see other people clinging to these ideas, the way that we have this idea of how things should be. And I know better. You don't know anything. So our beliefs and views and opinions, when we see them in ourselves, they're usually taken to be based on facts and true, and they're based on our experience, and they're perfectly reasonable, of course they are. And when other people have them, we may consider, oh, that's a little bit idiosyncratic, or it's unproven, or they're being too rigid, or they're not being broad-minded enough. But sometimes our beliefs are unexamined opinions or some assumptions we have that we have for perfectly good reasons. We inherited them from other people, from our culture, or that perhaps they're based on circumstances or experiences that are no longer relevant or no longer accurate. And I'm talking about them being under underlying conflict, but actually our beliefs underlie all our actions. It affects our daily decisions, it affects our relationships, on our values and our goals, and what choices we make in morally difficult situations when we're not quite sure what to do. So the Buddha and his teachings about Tathāgata, the King of Gods, is about to see the relationship between the beliefs and our actions. And we can look at this in either way. We can look at our actions and just gently inquire, what is underneath that? What is the reason? What was the thinking behind that? Not in a way that we have to do like an archaeological dig and figure out it's because a thing happened when I was 8. But it's more like just to notice we might have some thoughts that it's important that everybody like me all the time. It's fantastic when people like you. It's uncomfortable when people don't like you. But maybe in order to have people like you all the time, you have to compromise something that's important for you or not stand up for something that needs to be stood up for. Or maybe you have an underlying belief that the world is a scary place and I need to be vigilant and always paying attention and taking care and know everything that's happening and to plan way far in advance, do lots and lots of planning in order so that I can feel safe. Or you might have an underlying belief that there's only a limited amount of love in the world. If other people have love, then that's a little bit less that's available for me. And so you're not happy when you see other people experiencing love, giving love. You feel a little bit like, oh, there's a limited supply and somehow you didn't get any. These are subtle, these types of beliefs. We often don't notice them. And not only are they subtle, but they also can be resistant to change or resistant to evaluation. So the Buddhist teachings aren't that we have to get rid of all of our beliefs. That's not helpful. That's a dead end. The teachings are to just know what they are. Just for us to be aware, to gently inquire. I wonder what's underneath that. And is that true with some of our own thoughts? Is that right? Not in a way so that we can beat ourselves up, not in a way that we can undermine everything that we use to make sense of our lives and use to make sense of our world, but just so that we can maybe introduce a little bit of more spaciousness, a little bit kind of spirit of inquiry. What is that about? There are some spiritual traditions where this is a big part of the practice. It's just to ask, is this true? Is this absolutely true? Because usually the first answer is, yes, of course it's true, especially when we're looking at our thoughts, right? I mean, I'm thinking it, so of course it's true. But then to ask a second time, is it absolutely true? And then what we might discover is that we have experiences, we have ideas that support our beliefs, that support our thoughts. And we have other experiences that don't. Sometimes we tend to discount the ones that don't support our views, that don't support our beliefs. So we start to see that, okay, so maybe this belief and that what's under, what's the foundation of this action that I'm doing, this activity that I'm doing, isn't as rock solid as I thought. And maybe that's okay. It's a big part of practice is, can we learn to see how things maybe aren't as solid, as permanent, aren't just big black boxes as sometimes they seem. Sometimes they appear if we don't just gently inquire into them. So this practice asks us to be curious, to inquire about the beliefs and the opinions we hold. Many of them are not obvious to us, and they may not become clear until they are threatened. Until we are sitting next to somebody at a family reunion and they're saying something that disturbs us greatly, and then we realize, like, oh, wow, okay, that's really against something that's really important to me. Or maybe we don't know or understand some of our beliefs until they're reflected back to us. Reflected back to us by our teachers, by our friends. Sometimes our enemies are the ones who, this word enemies, people we find difficult or that we don't get along with. Could be a great place to kind of just investigate, well, what are some of my underlying beliefs? What are some of my views that are in why I don't get along and that kind of support this conflict? So we can inquire about our beliefs and opinions and then inquire a little bit more deeply. Not so that we have to change them, not so that we have to abandon them, just so that they don't push us around so much. We can decide, is this something that I want to modify a little bit? We can decide, is this something that's supportive and nourishing and helpful? Is this something that is onward leading towards greater freedom, greater understanding? So we can decide. But often if we don't know what these underlying beliefs are, we don't know. We're pushed around and we find ourselves in conflict after conflict after conflict. In the kind of in the Buddhist teaching, some particular beliefs that we might want to gently inquire about is this idea of, why do we think that we have souls or that we don't have souls? What's underlying that? Or we might ask, what are our moral principles really based on? What guides our behavior? What's underneath that? So becoming aware of our beliefs is one way in which we can work with conflict. From this we can see that there's an emphasis on noticing what is our role in the conflict instead of trying to go out there and fix everybody and change and manufacture and make everything better. There's a place for that too, but there's a real emphasis on knowing our own role. What are we contributing to the disputes and the conflicts and difficulties? But there's something else that we can do also to help us with conflicts and disputes we find ourselves in. And I heard this from somebody who attributed it to Gil Fronstall. So I'm assuming Gil said this, but if he didn't, I like the saying anyway. He has this expression, "Be still and look upon everything kindly. Be still and look upon everything kindly. Be still." Sometimes it's not until we quiet the mind, until we come to a place like IMC and meditate, or we meditate at home, that we can start to see some of these little wispy thoughts that often are just quickly going through the mind. In the guided meditation earlier, I invited you to look at what is your response when you notice that the mind has been lost in thought. Often we don't notice that. But that little thing, like, oh, shoot, I was lost in thought again. And then there might be a whole story that starts this whole, I can't do this meditation thing. Look at everybody else. They're probably all enlightened. They're sitting there so still. I'm the only one here that can't do it. I'm just making this up, of course, right? But we all have versions of kind of story that we have. Or maybe we have the opposite too, like, oh, look, here I am mindful again. I got this. I don't know why other people think it's so hard. What are they talking about? Why do we have to sit for so long? I've already been mindful. But this idea to be still, often some of those quiet thoughts sometimes are on the periphery of what we're thinking about primarily, are a clue to some of our beliefs. The ones that just kind of like pop up and we don't really pay that much attention to. But they pop up repeatedly. They're like a theme. And in fact, they may feel so familiar because we've heard them so many times. We may not even question them. They just feel like the truth. But part of this practice is the invitation. Can we even notice those? Is that true? Is it absolutely true? So that's one thing that can happen when we be still, as Gil says. We can quiet the mind and start to see some of those little wispy thoughts. Something else that can happen when we quiet the mind is that we can start to see maybe a bigger picture of what's happening. Might start to see the blind men or the blind persons, the blind people and the elephant, how they, if we can quiet the mind, we can maybe see like, oh, there's probably a reason why this person insists like that this elephant is like a mortar, when I insist that it's like a pestle. A pestle and a mortar are very different. Well, there must be a reason. I wonder why. But sometimes we're so busy in our minds, we feel threatened, we're tightened even more around our views, defending ourselves, making the other person look bad, thinking they're bad, whatever it might be. But if we can quiet the mind, sometimes in that space, then these extra questions might come up. Oh yeah, there must be a reason why this person is saying that. I wonder what it is. I'm going to ask them. So that's one way in which our perspectives might change. Then here's a very, very, very short verse, also from the Buddhist literature. And the Buddha says, "Many do not realize that we here will die. For those who do realize this, quarrels end." Puts things in perspective, right? we think that maybe we're not quite ready to think that we're going to die. We are going to die. We're going to die. But people we love are going to die. Maybe the person that we're in conflict with is going to die. Then it just kind of puts things in a different view. Like, is it really that important? I recently had a death in the family, and I noticed this, how so many of us family members, we just put so many things aside and instead came together and supported one another. I feel quite happy and to be able to be part of that. I saw this firsthand where it just kind of just gained some clarity about what's really important. I'm wishing for you that you don't have to experience a death before you start to realize that some of our conflicts, some of our disputes aren't worth the trouble. Can we hold our beliefs in an open-handed way? Can we hold our views, our opinions in an open-handed way? So that we don't have to be in conflict with others. Doesn't mean that we're agreeing with others. It means that we're not in conflict with them. That's different. We're not saying everybody else is right. We're not saying that we're right. We're saying, you know, my current thinking is right now this makes sense to me. My current hypothesis is that this right now makes sense to me. I'm pretty sure this is the way it is. That's different than saying this is the truth and everything else is wrong. And then the second part of Gill's quote. The first part, so the quote is, "Be still and look upon everything kindly." So look upon everything kindly. To do this work, and it is work. It's not easy. It's not necessarily fun. To do this work, to inquire, what are our underlying beliefs? What are our views? What are our opinions? It requires a certain amount of open-heartedness and open-mindedness. Right, as we discover things about ourselves, as we investigate, as we learn, it's not always good news. We might see things about ourselves that we wish we hadn't seen. Like, oh. You know, we have these views for reasons. You know, we inherited them. We had experiences that supported them. The work here is to look at them and hold them with kindness. We're not going to beat ourselves up because we have them. We're not going to throw them away. We're just going to hold them with kindness. Oh, okay. So this is part of my life too, that I have this belief. And then it's uncomfortable to see beliefs that you wish you didn't have. And it's uncomfortable to not only see that you have this, but to watch yourself do actions based on those beliefs that perhaps aren't the most skillful, aren't the most helpful. But it's a habit, and you watch yourself do it anyway. It's uncomfortable. It might even be painful. But this is how it works. This is how we get a life that is meaningful and beautiful and filled with peace and ease, as we turn to look, and when we find things that are uncomfortable, we hold it with kindness and allow it to unfold, allow it to shift, allow it to change, morph. Notice I'm using the word allow. I'm not using this word shove or make or hit with a sledgehammer or obliterate or anything like this. It's quite something what happens when some of our beliefs and our ideas just get shown the light of day, so to speak. Then they start to just shift on their own. We don't have to make these things happen. We just have to have the open-heartedness, the open-mindedness to be able to see, to look, to gently inquire. Is this true? Is this absolutely true? Something else that we might do when we find ourselves in conflict and kind of goes along with this look upon everything kindly. Can we look on the other person with whom we are in conflict with? Can we look upon them kindly? Maybe even having this idea is enough that it's something different can arise if we've been embroiled in some really conflict. Whether it's a person that we actually are having a conflict and fighting with, or maybe it's somebody we don't actually know, but it's we're having a lot of conflict with what this person says and or does. Can we let them have the other person, can we let them have a small victory, any type of victory? Can we say, okay, that's a good point what you said there, but I don't agree with this over here. Okay, I can see how that makes sense to you, but I have an experience, I have information that you might not have. It makes sense to me. I can see the logic in what you're saying, but I don't have the same assumption you have. Can we allow them to have some, to acknowledge where they're coming from, to acknowledge that what they're saying makes some sense in some kind of way? And if not, just to say, you know, I understand this and this, but I don't understand that. That's a way to treat them with respect and kindness. Instead of just kind of like wholesale dismissing them. I don't need to listen to you. That's not the way to greater freedom and peace. That's not the way. And then this one last thing about this idea of look upon everything kindly. Here's yet one more verse from the Buddhist literature. Maybe you've heard this one. Also, this one's well known. It gets translated in lots of different ways. This translation is Gill's. This is very powerful. Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. We can't hate our way out of hatred. Hatred is a strong word here, but right, you can't just add hatred on top of hatred and think that the hatred's going to go away. I like this word, non-hate. We don't use this in English very much. In the way that I'm holding it, the way that I'm interpreting it, it doesn't have to mean love. For me, that's a tall order. If we're embroiled in some conflict, in some dispute, to have this idea I'm supposed to love. But can we get away from the bad feelings? Can we get away from the bitterness and the resentment and the wanting to jab and poke? Can we get away from the wanting to somehow harm, the hostility, whatever might be there? It's only non-hate that allows the end of hatred. So in this idea about conflict, in the Buddha, when he describes a wise person, a person who's enlightened, a person who's awakened, he describes them as somebody who doesn't get involved with conflict, who doesn't get involved in disputes. Not because they don't know and experiencing maybe the most powerful things that it's possible for humans to know and experience. Because they see that there's no need for conflict and dispute. They don't need to get into fights with people. I'm not saying that we shouldn't withhold boundaries, that we shouldn't let people know when they have crossed our boundaries. I'm not saying that we should allow people to do whatever they want. I'm saying that can we act and can we do what needs to be done in a way without getting embroiled, tied up, tangled in these ongoing conflicts, ongoing disputes? Can we see what our own role is? Can we see what underlying beliefs we have that is supporting this tangled, getting tangled up? Can we find a way to maybe just soften or maybe take care of ourselves? Like, okay, this is something that's really important to me. I feel tender around this. And I don't feel quite ready that I can be in a way in which I can let this go or allow other people to trample over something that feels very important to me. But can we do that in a way that is with kindness and care for ourselves, and kindness and care for others? And maybe when we find ourselves lost in disputes or conflicts, maybe it's even with ourselves, maybe we can just be still and look upon everything kindly. Maybe something else can bubble up. Maybe there's some space or an opportunity for a different way of showing up. So I think I'll stop there and I'll open it up for if there's some questions or comments.
Could you repeat the verse about hatred never ends with hatred?
Yes, I'd love to. Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth.
Since we repeated that, so do you think non-hatred or non-hate equates to equanimity?
Nice. Yeah, thank you. Can we have some balance? Can we have some even-mindedness? Can we see the big picture, all these kind of different ways of thinking about equanimity? Thank you, yeah.
When we talk about conflict, the one thing that comes to mind is that in nature, in the state of nature, other species, other animals other than ourselves, it's filled with conflict. It's built on, people talk about predator and prey, and when I hear the verses that you quoted, it sounds as if we're looking at our species as extra special, that we could, how should I say, transcend this, but yet at the same time, nature, it's part of what nature is. So there's a dimension here of, are we trying to go against a state of nature? Are we trying to undo this or not accept almost a reality? So there's something going on there. I'm not sure, but it's something I think about.
Yeah.
Wrestle with.
In my mind, predator prey isn't conflict. That's the way nature is, right? Of course, one species is preying on another species, but that's a little bit different. Here I'm talking about disputes, kind of like wrangling, lawsuits or, you know, this kind of yelling and this kind of thing, this type of conflict. I mean, right, there's, of course, there's lots of, as you said, right, nature, of course, has lots of things that have, let's see, so what's an alternative word? Maybe you have an alternative word than conflict, then. And so...
I'm not sure, but I've often thought about, when it comes to like conflict resolution, that alternative forms of conflict resolution involve dialogue, listening, mediation, as opposed to violence. So we look at dissension, and we think about how can we resolve that in ways which respect sort of individuals' awareness and the wider reality. So it's the way the conflict is resolved that becomes the magic, so to speak. The conflict itself is something which can be resolved in many ways, in positive ways. And so I guess if there's a value judgment, the value judgment, if any, is the resolution of it as opposed to it per se, if we even want to attribute a value judgment or engage in that practice.
I see. So I am making a value judgment. I am saying that part of the reason why we do this practice, and kind of like Buddhism in general would say, is to greater and greater peace and greater freedom, greater and greater ease. And having more and more conflict is not the same direction as greater and greater freedom and peace. But we did get away from this idea that, you know, what animals are doing is something different. Yeah, yeah.
I think you brought up a word that you just mentioned in talking about conflict resolution that I think is very important in the ideas that you've brought forth here, and that the word is dialogue. So much of what we do in our day-to-day conflicts and our arguments and our petty disputes and all of the whole spectrum of which there are is diatribe. We cling to... I'm right. I've got to be right at all because my ego's wrapped up in it. And there's so many other things that we just cling on to because, I mean, and it's like you were saying, a lot of it's really kind of minimal stuff or maybe very fundamental stuff. But at the same time, it's, you know, you think like you do. I think like I do. We can agree to disagree. But so much of what we do as humans is built on this concept of diatribe rather than dialogue, which involves inquiry, it involves listening, it involves sharing, and that's like the holistic approach to that. But we just want to be, blah, 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 blah. I've said my piece and I don't want to listen, and you know, nah, 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 nah. I don't want to hear anything else. So I think that's a very important distinction. I'm not sure when you first began, you'd mentioned that how these wisdoms are passed along in a lot of different spiritual traditions, and you referenced a poem in the late 1800s. I'm not sure if what struck to my mind was the Serenity Prayer. I'm not sure if that's the one that you were mentioning, but it's so much we can agree to disagree. There's, you know, this acceptance of things that we cannot change, but we can share. We can you know. We can all have different beliefs, and we can appreciate it, and we can accept them, but we get caught up so much on clinging to being right or, you know. I also relate to the example. I'm thinking of my mother, who's terminally ill, and she and her sister, who live in the same little town in Virginia for 30 years since my grandfather passed, have been – they haven't talked to each other. Mm-hmm. The rest of the family is spread around, and they've locked on it. And I've told her time and time again, I'm like, one day – one of you is going to pass, and that the one who is left is going to be is going to realize it's like I've wasted 35 years, and you know, nieces and cousins and all this stuff. It's so much was lost because they've clung on to their stubborn, silly little disputations, and you know, there's going to be a reckoning to that, unfortunately, one day. And I don't know.
Thank you. And I like this distinction between diatribe and dialogue. I didn't talk that much about dialogue here, but it's a nice distinction. Thank you. I have to look at this clock, right? Not that clock. We have time for one more comment, if anybody'd like to make a comment.
This brings to mind what we're up against, almost an existential threat, is the stuff that goes on social media today and the algorithms in Facebook, Google, wherever, tend to lead to reactions rather than responses.
Yeah.
Or what Tristan Harris calls the race to the bottom of the brainstem. You know?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's something really to reckon with. And I'm glad we're here, among other, to attempt to push it the other way. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark. Yeah, that which is most outrageous, right, kind of gets promoted and spun around, and what's outrageous is what pushes our buttons, and yeah, doesn't lead to greater freedom and peace. Okay, so I wish you all a wonderful evening, and may you find some peace and freedom and maybe a little bit of space and some of those conflicts or disputes you may be involved in. Thank you.